Trump, 77 years old, from running for office, cites the 14th Amendment's disqualification clause, which prohibits any person who has engaged in insurrectional rebellion against the Constitution from holding federal or state office. The Supreme Court declined to hear the lawsuit filed by John Castro, a Republican presidential candidate, in an unsigned order. Castro's lawsuit was previously dismissed by a federal judge in June, who argued that Castro failed to show a legal injury. "The fight is far from being over," Castro tweeted on Monday. "We're going to get the liberal Ninth Circuit to kick Donald Trump off the ballot in Montana, Idaho, Nevada, and Arizona. Coupled with the First Circuit kicking him off the main ballot, there is zero path to 270. Castro has filed lawsuits to keep Donald Trump off the ballot in various states and said he will not be deterred despite the High Court's decision. "The Supreme Court can deny to hear the case, but appellate courts cannot. I'm still pursuing decisions in the liberal appellate courts, and there's a full-blown trial scheduled for 20th of October in New Hampshire, and a bench trial is scheduled in Arizona on 31st of October," he tweeted. The seldom-used disqualification clause was included in the post-Civil War 14th Amendment as a means to prevent former Confederate officials from becoming elected officials and taking over state governments and the federal government. Several liberal nonprofit groups have filed lawsuits citing the 14th Amendment in an effort to keep Donald Trump off ballots in 2024.
The last messenger of the heavens. Man was created on the morning of the sixth day. The time of worship commenced, and Adam began the rituals for his Lord. He, and after him, his progeny, performed such rituals. Religions appeared one after another. All of them represented one God, one path, one origin, and one end to mankind. Every messenger who was appointed by God to convey his message informed the people of the advent of the last prophet of God. In this sense, Buddha and Krishna said the very same thing which Noah, Abraham, Moses, John, Zoroaster, and Jesus said. One told the name of the final prophet, and the other spoke of his origin. One forecast the signs of his homeland, while the other described the characteristics of his language. In one way or another, each prophet informed mankind of the joyous news of the advent of the final prophet, the last messenger of the heavens. In the very beginning of history, God sent Adam, his first prophet on earth, to propagate and show the heavenly path to the inhabitants of this world. Thousands of years have passed ever since, and some people continue to follow him by residing exclusively near the riverbanks of the world. Zoroastrianism is one of the most ancient religions of the world. These days, most of its followers are found in Iran, India, and some regions of Central Asia. They possess a heritage several thousand years old. Like the prophets before him, Zoroaster also informed his followers of the coming of divine prophets. The religious scripts of Zoroastrianism refer to these messengers as Sotians. There are three Sotians who were foretold to appear after the Zoroaster. Alternatively, three Sotians, three beneficent personalities, will come one after the other. Throughout history, the followers of Zoroaster have been waiting for their arrival. They have searched for them everywhere.
Attilo! What brings you here?
They are visitors from the east. They follow the star. The star of the prophecy.
The prophecy of the Messiah?
The Messiah!
So far, only three Zoroastrian sages have succeeded in seeing the first Sotient in Bethlehem. When the last prophet of God appeared in Hejaz, there were many Zoroastrians who saw the signs of the second Sotient in him. They joined him in large numbers and became his followers and helpers. However, there are still many Zoroastrians who are keenly waiting for the arrival of the third Sotient. They hope that this universal reformer will appear and make the world a utopia. In India, the land of many creeds, there are several mysterious religions spread out in the vast jungles and mountainous regions. Here, you find religions such as Hinduism, Jainism, Buddhism, and Sikhism. Though, in some case, the followers of these religions have become deviated from the right path. The depth of meaning and spirituality that these religions reveal is indicative of man's inherent tendency to establish a close relationship with an infallible creator and worship him. Historical roots of Hinduism are spread over thousands of years. Mysterious ascetics with wonderful conducts live all over India, in colorful shrines and dark temples in legendary jungles. They make the unspeakable things of this mysterious land even more mysterious.
God is one only. Even in India, in the Hindu philosophy, God is always one. But his manifestation is many.
This historical religion has several holy books as guidelines for its followers. These books are full of strange and unsaid mysteries. Among the sacred books of Hindus are the Puranas. These ancient books contain the history of the universe, the genealogy of kings and heroes, and the foretelling of future events. In these books, we again witness indications of the coming of a spiritual teacher called Muhammad from a foreign land. To him is what Raja Bhuj respectfully says, "I prostrate myself before you, O you, the pride of mankind, the inhabitant of Arabia. You have gathered a great power to eradicate Satan."
In one of the Puranas in India, Bhavishya Purana, it is also mentioned that Mahamud, Paigambar Muhammad, will be born in the Middle East and he would cleanse the people of corruption and bad habits there, and you know, he will bring a new wave of devotion. This is mentioned thousands of years ago in the Hindu text, in a Purana. It's one verse is there, one quote is there, that such and such a person, a prediction was done about that.
He will appear in a sandy desert in the land of Arabia. He will be known as the pride of humanity, and his name is Muhammad. What could be the secret that has been also mentioned in the holy books of Hindus, and of which the Hindu monks have spoken? The history of Jainism goes back about 600 years before the appearance of Christ. According to Jainism, salvation can only be achieved through the practice of asceticism. The tenets of this faith dictate that God has 24 avatars on earth. The last one of them will be born in a peninsula, and the name of his father is Vishnu Bhagat, which is the equivalent of Abdullah, and the name of his mother is Somanib, which is the equivalent of Amina. He is said to be taught by Bhagwan in a cave. Sikhs, who wear a unique turban on their head, are followers of another religion in India. But are there any hints about the Holy Prophet of Islam and his religion in the scriptures of Sikhs? In addition to the promise made thousands of years ago by Eastern religions concerning the advent of a prophet called Muhammad in Arabia, Abrahamic religions also foretell the arrival of a great prophet on earth in the last age of humanity. Moses and Jesus endured many difficulties on the path of propagating their messages. They promised the people about the advent of a man from among the descendants of Abraham. The New Testament clearly promises the arrival of a prophet after Christ. An example of this can be seen in the Gospel of John. Shortly before the advent of Christ, Roman oppression was continuously increasing. More and more innocent people were crucified every day, and the poor were made even poorer through forced taxes. In such conditions, a man called John, from the shores of the Jordanian River, claimed prophecy. He kindled both doubt and hope in the hearts of the Jews of his time. Perhaps they wondered whether he was Messiah, the prophet foretold to end pain and tragedy. On the same day, Jewish leaders sent a group of Levites to John to investigate the matter.
Who are you?
John confessed. He did not deny. He answered,
I am not the Messiah.
Who are you then?
Are you Elijah?
No, I'm not.
Are you the prophet?
No.
Then tell us who you are.
We have to take an answer back to those
when
who sent
prophet
us.
When John replied that he was not Messiah, Elijah, or the promised prophet, the delegates, who were considering the new prophet to be one of these three, asked him in wonder.
If you're not the Messiah, nor Elijah, nor the prophet, why do you baptize?
I baptize with water. But among you stands the one you do not know. He is coming after me, but I'm not good enough even to untie his sandals.
John's Gospel contains a marvelous secret within it. This secret, which reveals itself exclusively to those possessing wisdom and intellect, promises the advent of another prophet after Jesus. It speaks of a messenger for whom everyone is waiting. When Christ embarked upon his three-year-long mission, a great disagreement occurred among people.
And whoever believes in me should drink. As the scripture says, streams of life-giving water will pour out from his side.
This man is really the prophet. The Messiah will not come from Galilee.
Many people said that he was the Messiah promised by the Bible. However, others did not agree to this and said that perhaps he was the foretold prophet. What we can understand from John's Gospel is that apart from Elijah, two other people must also come to mankind. One is the Messiah, and the other is, for the lack of a better title, the prophet. But where is the prophet, who according to John's Gospel must come, and has yet to come?
All the Christianity believe in the genuineness of Prophet Muhammad. I mean, believe that he was a prophet or not.
I do not know for all of Christianity. I have no doubt. I have no doubt myself. He is a prophet, and spoke the word of God with great love and kindness and beauty.
Yes,
the prophet is a symbol. The prophet is a human being. Human being, not God. He's a human being that he had great faith, a maximum of the faith, and he was in contact with God when he was alive. And he passed the messages of God to the people.
Will Durant writes, according to the documents discovered on the shores of the Dead Sea, people were awaiting the foretold prophet, whose appearance, along with that of the Messiah, was promised. But who is this prophet, and from where does he originate? In order to answer this question, we will have to go back and investigate his characteristics, as found in the Old Testament. According to the Old Testament, Moses saved the children of Israel from the Egyptians' bondage and made them cross the sea. He guided them during the course of 40 years of wandering in the Sinai Desert until they reached the banks of the Jordanian River. Nevertheless, the Israelites continued their lives as nomads. For this reason, Moses gathered them all and said, God told me, I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren like unto thee, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak unto them all, that I shall command him, and it shall come to pass, that whosoever will not hearken unto my words, which he shall speak in my name, I will require it of him. The Bible only recognizes the children of Ishmael as the brethren of the Israelites. Hence, the foretold prophet must have been raised among the brethren of the Israelites. He must have been given a book like that of Moses, and he must have come with a religious law like that of Moses. The question stands, to which prophet can all these qualities be attributed? Priest James Dow writes in the Collins Dictionary of the Bible, "The only personality for whom the forecast of Torah can fit is Muhammad, because he is the only person who resembles Moses and has a book and a religious law." The prophets came one after the other and guided humanity towards the truth. Every prophet promised his followers about the advent of the last messenger of God. Muhammad, about whom the Puranas had promised. The second sociant of the Zoroastrians. A prophet from Arabia. The last avatar riding on a horse. The prophet resembling Moses and the descendant of the brethren of the Israelites. And the prophet mentioned in John's Gospel. Who is he? In which land was he raised? In which era did he render as true the promise of all the prophets before him, after centuries of denial and defiance by the unbelievers? Muhammad, the son of Abdullah, titled as Ahmad, the seal of all prophets, from the house of Ishmael, appeared in the land of the Arabs to guide mankind, so that man may not remain in the darkness of ignorance. And now, on the threshold of another millennium, man continues the path of his predecessors in the persecution of the propagators of the message of God. Those who decapitated Prophet John, put the cross on the shoulders of Christ, and mounted the Crusades, are once again continuing with their blasphemous persecution of the last prophet of God. They fed their ancient grudge. They despised the sacred. And driven to despair, they set fire to the truth and tried desperately to injure the prophet.
There is no God but God, and Muhammad is the messenger of God. There is no God but God, and Muhammad is the messenger of God.
Protect the prophet!
Are declaring ourselves. God has told his messenger to declare Islam to all men.
Open the windows. Let the world hear.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Britain's prison population has been steadily rising since 2020, and there are now 87,793 inmates locked up. As of 29th of September, capacity across the whole estate stood at 88,561. The British government estimates these figures will only get worse, with the prison population expected to increase to between 93,000 and 106,000 by March of 2027. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. Criminals may be released from jail early or not locked up in the first place, as figures uncovered recently show overcrowding in UK prisons to nearly breaking point. New statistics reveal the majority of prisons are now dangerously full, with some, including Wandsworth, where former soldier Daniel Khalifa is accused of escaping, holding 70% more inmates than they should. The shortfall prompted warnings from the Chief of Prison Governors, former Home Secretary Jack Straw, and former Tory Prisons Minister Rory Stewart, who all warned that early release may have to be considered to tackle the crisis. Talk of drastic measure comes as latest figures show nearly two-thirds of jails in England are officially overcrowded, with just 768 free spaces within the entire prison state. A prison union threatened to take legal action if the Ministry of Justice asked governors to find extra capacity in already packed prisons. And His Majesty's Inspector of Prisons said prisons were already being asked to double up in cells to avert crisis. Experts warned of the longer-term problem of accommodating prisoners even if short-term fixes are found. The prison governor's chief warned the nuclear button could be pressed very soon, as the system runs dangerously close to capacity. Andrea Olbutt, president of the Prisoners Governors Association, said it was common sense that the government would have to consider an early release scheme for thousands of prisoners, adding, "The fact is we're overcrowded to the nth degree, and there is no capacity left. Once we are full, we are full." She added, "We are reaching the critical point, the point of no return. In the adult male estate, there are only a few hundred spaces left, and that will be consumed within the next couple of weeks." Jack Straw, who as Labour's Justice Secretary oversaw an early release scheme for prisoners, said although he was not updated on the current state of prisons, the government was facing a perfect storm arising from the willful neglect of the whole criminal justice system over the past 13 years. Discussing early release, Jack Straw went on, "The government would find that very uncomfortable, but they may have to do it." He added, "Rishi Sunak, Suella Braverman and Alex Chalk need to realise the state of the crisis and that the government is failing in one of its fundamental duties to keep people safe." And Stewart said those in power should have the courage to abolish short prison sentences for minor offenders in a bid to tackle the issue. Stewart added, "The only way of addressing this is for a political party to have the courage to reduce the prison population. They will never be able to build enough prisons to keep up. Let's abolish short sentences in prison for minor offences and let's reduce the length of sentences. We should be learning from Europe, not the United States, and locking up fewer people." Britain's prison population has been steadily rising since 2020, and there are now 87,793 inmates locked up in British prisons. As of 29th of September, capacity across the whole estate stood at 88,561. According to August statistics from the Ministry of Justice, His Majesty's prison at Wandsworth is at 170% occupancy. His Majesty's prison at Leeds is currently at 172% occupancy, and His Majesty's prison at Durham is at 171%. The government estimates these figures will only get worse, with the prison population expected to increase to between 93,000 and 106,000 by March of 2027. Justice Committee Chair Sir Bob Neill has warned that even if the new prisons in the pipeline are completed on time, there would still be a shortfall in March of 2025 of 2,300 places. His Majesty's Inspector of Prisons, Charlie Taylor, warned prisons may hit a crisis point in the next 6 months to a year, but said that temporary measures such as using police cells under a scheme known as Operation Safeguard could alleviate the situation. However, he expressed concern that this will eventually come to a head as the prison population grows. Police cells have been used to house prisoners 871 times between February, when the scheme started, and June. Charlie Taylor said, in the longer term, there's a much more protracted problem where we won't be able to accommodate people anymore. You've got three choices. You either build a bigger bath, let some of the water out of the bath, or turn off the taps. He added, overcrowding affects everything. It means prisoners spend longer locked up. There's more pressure on showers, pressure on getting out for exercise, rising levels of violence. A prison is classified as overcrowded if the number of prisons held exceeds the certified normal accommodation, or CNA. The certified normal accommodation is set by the prison service and is the number of spots available for prisoners under a decent standard of accommodation. The operational capacity is the absolute maximum number of prisoners that could fit into the prison. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. A recent analysis shows that 78 out of the 124 jails in England and Wales have a population greater than the number of certified normal accommodation, or CNA, spaces. Britain's Ministry of Justice has claimed it is taking measures to reduce the demand pressures on the system, including increasing within safe limits the number of prisoners held in the existing estate, and bringing non-critical maintenance cells back online. All non-critical maintenance work has also been paused. The department has also expanded the home detention curfew scheme, allowing prisoners to be released from jail earlier under conditions such as tagging. Internal analysis from May found this would free up to 300 prison spaces. Magistrates have also been told to have an awareness of the impact of the current prison population levels when issuing sentences. Andrea Allbutt, president of the Prison Governors Association, said the situation was making work very dangerous for governors. She added, if the government further overcrowded our prisons, if they say to our members, you will put more people in your already overcrowded prison, we will take legal action. Labour MP Andy Slaughter, who has His Majesty's prison at Wormwood Scrubs in his constituency, has written to the Justice Secretary to share his concerns about the underlying problems of staffing and overcrowding in prisons. Andy Slaughter added, the overcrowding could actually be worse than is realised. We'll be right back.
Prophet and Files. Over 80% of the world's population uses a smartphone, but what over 80% of the world's population probably never thinks about is the true cost of the cobalt used in the batteries of smartphones, laptops, and electric vehicles. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi. And today we're going to tell you a story of hands. Hands that have for long been hurt beyond imagination while harvesting the main ingredients to our industries. But before we start today's story, we need to properly set the scene, because though the country we're going to talk about is home to one of the poorest nations in the world, the land itself is perhaps the richest land on earth, or the country in question. The Democratic Republic of Congo, the country with the most abundant resources known on earth, and yet home to one of the 10 most impoverished nations in the world. But it was at the hands of these impoverished people that Europe experienced its industrial boom in the late 1800s. And it all started with some of the same trees that you saw in the picture, the rubber tree. From bicycle tires to industrial bands, rubber played a big role in answering Europeans' daily demands, especially with the rubber boom in the mid-1800s. But rubber does not grow in Europe. And that's where the story of a Belgian king and his Congo comes in. The story about the toil of hands and their unlikely reward. Now, who was this Belgian king we're talking about, and what did he do?
King Leopold II was born to the first royal family following Belgium's independence. He seized Congo with the help of the explorer Henry Morton Stanley in mid-1880s. The king and his forces drained the land of resources, killing elephants for ivory and cutting down trees for rubber. The United States became the first country to recognize his claim to the Congo. Congolese hands were systematically amputated during his rule. The severed hands were then collected and smoked by the colonists to be preserved for later counting and recording. King Leopold was responsible for the biggest genocide in history, with 10 to 15 million killed by torture, famine, and diseases, and many others systematically maimed. The king was honored with Great Britain's most prestigious title, a member of the Order of the Garter, in 1916. Thousands of signatures and recent protests by Belgian people have called for the removal of his statues and the payment of reparations to the victims of the colonial crimes.
The people were clearly being punished for something, but that something was neither negligence nor a crime. Their Belgian masters had decided a certain rubber quota for them to harvest, and they had failed to reach their quota. But it wasn't only these slaves who had to pay for this failure. Let's just say the Belgian punishment system for the Congolese who hadn't met their quota included cutting off the hands and feet of their loved ones. According to statistics, between 10 to 15 million Congolese were killed by King Leopold II during his 23 years of ownership of Congo. And though this number is millions more than the number of those killed in other genocides, few people know about Congo's Holocaust. At the time, this genocide committed by the Belgians slashed Congo's population in half. Imagine that, half of the population gone. But it's best to hear about all of this from one of our guests today, who is a historian specializing in colonialism in Africa.
Brothomeo Gabriel is an activist and a member of an anti-colonialist imperialist organization called No White Saviors in Uganda. He specializes in African history, and with the organization, they have opened a Pan-African library in Kampala. He's also a social media expert and uses this specialty to educate the masses about the true history of Africa.
Thank you so much for being with us on the program today. Can you talk about the legacy of the Belgian king, King Leopold II, that legacy that he had on Congo?
We first have to highlight how, unlike other colonies, or unlike other entities that were classified as colonies, Leopold classified the Congo as a private property. It's vast land that had people on it, that had resources, that had landscapes and animals, was essentially the private property of one individual. And with that came his self-imposed right to do whatever he saw fit to exploit the people of the land however he saw fit. And the fact that it was private property meant that even the Belgian government, if I may say, at that time, all the Belgian political bodies didn't have a right to dictate or to interfere in whatever decision he took. And we see that with this came a reign of terror for the Congolese people, for the Congolese, Rwandan, and Burundian people. Because when we often talk about the Congo talk about Belgium, we often leave out the fact that Rwanda and Burundi also faced similar atrocities at the hands of the Belgians.
I mean, it's estimated up to 15 million Congolese were killed during Leopold's reign. Do you think that these numbers are accurate?
It could have possibly been more than 15 million. I'm one of the people who believe it was more than 15 million because when you look at the systemic situation as it was, the fact that for every hand that was chopped, it had to be accounted for. Every bullet that was fired had to be accounted for. So that meant taking back the arms of the victim, or the hands of the victim, back to the force public officials. I think that's how the force was referred to at that time. I'm not quite good with my French isn't quite good. But you see that the institutional or systemic system as it was at that point promoted violence against Congolese people for any small thing. You could have fallen short on your rubber collection and, you know, your child would pay the price or your family member would pay the price. Even you yourself would pay the price. So imagine that going on for years, day in, day out, years. It's easy for anyone to see that 10 million is an understatement.
What exactly is happening today in Congo? Because we see growing calls by the Congolese for the United Nations to even leave the country.
Yes, they are cries by the Congolese population to have MONUSCO expelled. I think MONUSCO is the UN mission in Congo, something like that. And it isn't for, and this cause is for a justified reason by the Congolese people, that throughout the decades that the MONUSCO has been active, they have questioned their input because the Congolese people are being slaughtered. And oftentimes you see that the MONUSCO entity doesn't act, or the UN entity doesn't act, only when it benefits them. I don't know if you're aware, but I think it was last year, a UN truck in the eastern part of the Congo overturned, and out of the vehicle came bags of minerals. So for the Congolese people, they are literally tired of being exploited. They're literally tired of this pseudo-sense of, we're here to protect you, because that is not what is ongoing. The UN is plundering the wealth of the Congolese people, the wealth of the Congolese land.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today on Hidden Files. So many of the horror stories in Congo's past involve rubber slavery. The oppression of this nation today has far more to do with another type of resource. You see, in addition to its limitless water supply, rich forests, and fertile soil, Congo is home to some of the world's most precious and most used minerals. Congo has abundant mineral deposits of cobalt, gold, diamonds, petroleum, potash, lead, zinc, uranium, copper, phosphates, gold, manganese, natural gas, coltan, and a whole lot more. Congo's untapped raw deposits of raw materials are actually estimated at being 24 trillion dollars. Imagine that, $24 trillion. And Congo is the world's fourth largest producer of copper, copper that we use so much in this modern world of ours. 60% of the coltan on the planet, the reserves are in Congo. And perhaps most importantly, the country produces 70% of the world's cobalt, which is used in phones and laptops and other high-tech tools. You see, it's the Congolese who are the true owners of the cobalt. It's the Congolese who harvest it with their hands in unsafe mines. And it's the Congolese who suffer all kinds of health issues and birth defects as a result of this dangerous hands-on approach to cobalt harvest. And yet, in 2018, over 70% of the Congolese lived on less than $1.90 a day. Clearly, even though their country is no longer the private property of a Belgian king, they continue to have little to no share in their rich national resources. But how is this happening today in what's now called the DRC, or the Democratic Republic of Congo? Our next guest has some interesting answers, so let's find out more.
Tede Kofi is a broadcast journalist with credits on the BBC World Service and BBC Radio 5, where he presented Current Affairs magazine programs. Tet is a newspaper publisher and ran the Ethnic Media Group, publishing Asian and Afro-Caribbean titles. He has been a crisis media coach and consultant for multinational corporations, specializing in the arena of diversity management.
Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. We appreciate you being with us today on the program. I want your assessment of the effects of Leopold Reyn you think could have had on the overall psyche of the Congolese.
The barbarity, the savagery, and the cruelty that Leopold II wreaked on the Congo is one of the world's best-kept secrets. It is estimated that 10 million Congolese died, that he reduced the population of the country by about 70%. In the early days of Leopold, each Congolese man, able-bodied man, was supposed to produce 15 kilograms of rubber per day. If he did not produce that, his family would be rounded up, herded, and killed. And so if people didn't produce their quota, their hands were amputated. There were these bizarre scenes of people presenting like strings of male genitalia, Congolese male genitalia, just to show how many people that they had killed that day because they hadn't made their quota. Now, all of this was covered up by Leopold as an exercise in civilizing the savages, which we Africans were presented as. So he said that basically in the Congo Free State, which is basically my private fiefdom, I've gone over there to introduce them to God and Christianity. And of course, the missionaries were under dire admonitions never to reveal the truth, which of course ultimately leaked, because as slavery was abolished elsewhere, people started to ask questions about how Leopold was running this enterprise. And of course, the whole thing blew up in his face. And he then had to resort to burning all the national records to try and cover up and hide a genocide, which was, you know, in plain view. So again, this is another way in which, if you have lived through that kind of, let me call it a Holocaust, it's probably the greatest human genocide kind of in living memory. If you've been through that kind of genocide, the idea is to instill in the people obedience to authority and power.
How is it, though, that the exploitation of the Democratic Republic of Congo is still existing today, has taken place for so long a period of time?
The oldest playbook in the oldest, sorry, method in the playbook of any totalitarian or any controller is divide and rule. Divide and rule requires that because there are few of the abusers, you must get the people you are abusing to fight each other. As long as they are fighting each other, they cannot unite, because it is only when they are united that they can kick you out of your position of authority, command, and control. And so it is that Congo has always been destabilized by foreign powers and foreign interests who have a profound desire, but whose lifestyles are determined by the cheapness with which they can extract the strategic minerals that I listed before.
Right.
And so that is how it's played out for the Congo. And another way is to make sure that you have proxy governments which are propped up by foreign powers, doing essentially the bidding of the foreign powers, so that they can be the natural and easy exfiltration of the nation's wealth to the benefit of the foreign powers. So that's how it's always played. Divide and rule, proxy governments which are created by the foreign powers, and thus it has been to this very day. In fact, now there is another challenge, because colonialism moved to another stage when, by using local agents, the destabilization could be maintained. And even now, if you speak to any Congolese, they will tell you that the role of Rwanda is a very difficult one in their country. And many Congolese blame a lot of the conflicts, internal conflicts within the country, on the actions not only of the Rwandese, but also of the Ugandans.
Well, why haven't we seen reparations for the Congolese after all of the suffering that they have gone through?
For a crime to be expunged, you need recognition that the crime happened, you need regret for the crime happening, and you need recompense. Now, in terms of recognition of the crime happening, my goodness, if you ask anybody what comes out of Congo, what they'll tell you is Makalele, Vincent Kompany, Lualua, and Romelu Lukaku. They're top football players. Most people in the world don't even know what the history of the Congo is beyond some trite superficial modernities. In terms of regret, when the tooth of Patrice Lumumba was handed back to his family, here is the thing. There was no official apology, either on behalf of the Belgian state or on behalf of Leopold II, who committed most of those atrocities. So there is no regret there. And as for compensation, well, Congo's wealth is still being filched out of the country on a daily basis. And the parties who benefit from this are absolutely adamant about the maintenance of their profits. So it's a perfect storm for Africa's richest country. And you've got to think about the bigger picture as well. When Nkrumah stood up in Ghana, the independence of Africa was signaled. When Lumumba stood up in the Congo, the independence of the Congo was signaled. And the thing about these things is that they attract people who follow the cause. And so it is important in the interest of the controlling powers that Congo doesn't become as wealthy as she can be. What if then she starts supporting the rest of the other African countries, and then the yoke of colonialism will be broken one by one by one across the continent? If you want to defeat an enemy, you first defeat their champion, and Congo can be the champion of Africa. Just indeed, as Muammar Gaddafi could have been the champion of Africa. Look what happened to him.
Well, what is it going to take, in your perspective, to turn around the fate of the Democratic Republic of Congo?
All I can say is that if people are severely abused over a long period of time, it takes time for these people to heal, for them to find their center, and to make demands based on their own self-validation. So that work has to take place. But that work has to take place right now in the face of overwhelming media coverage, which makes sure that the only things people associate Congo with is Claude Makélélé and Victor Kompany, football players. People don't know outside of Africa the value and the condition of Congo. So all of this applies very, very negative pressure. On the other hand, the international community must write a new set of rules. And that set of rules should mean that all people, as said in the United Nations Charter, deserve respect and recognition. But at the moment, you know, the world is run by what one cartoonist called the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. And so as long as you've got this sort of moral relativism, it's going to be very challenging.
Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Tete Kufi. Appreciate it. But when we talk about the advancement of technology, we often think of prestigious universities and creative minds. Unfortunately, we rarely remember the suffering of hands without whose harvest the main ingredients of advancement would be missing. Hands like those of the Congolese that were cut off for the sake of rubber and the harvest of cobalt. The pain must be acknowledged and the price be paid. But from the Belgian monarchy that has brought about the genocide of the Congolese to the international corporations and various countries that continue to profit from the toil of the Congolese and the taking away of their resources, no entity has acknowledged the crime committed against these people, let alone apologize. Yet even a formal apology can hardly ever appease the victims of such horrible crimes. What good would an apology have done, for instance, the Congolese man who had to stare in shock at the severed body parts of his 5-year-old daughter? I can't even begin to imagine. Well, a true apology must be followed by a change in actions and in reparations, such as those that has for decades been paid by German citizens to those related to victims of Nazi atrocities. Perhaps someday soon, the oppressed nations of the world will begin to have the power to extract this apology from colonial powers of the past and present. But this power requires knowledge. For now, though, that's goodbye for me and all the crew right here at Hidden Files. Thank you so much for being with us, and let us hear from you, from your corner of the world. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
U.S. says will continue its illegal Syria occupation for many years. U.S.